Fiction, or 906 Harmony Drive. Chipping in. 43. He came out of surgery gray, half dead. What was meant to heal him was, for me, the start of his dying. That man, that immortal, my father, a fairly standard mid-century model, Updikean in his defects and indulgences, besotted by the American dream and completely unkillable, with at least a dozen second acts already behind him, was gone. In place of the unique article was an imitation. He had not undergone some life-saving surgery, but an experimental whole-body transplant into somebody half his size. He writhed around, looked bothered by the light. He appeared to have an allergy to his own skin. The morning after surgery, he came to, feeling for his teeth. Finding them in place, he swooned again. 2 days later, he could sit up. The doctor encouraged him to sip water, then to fast, then to sip again, to test the new seals on his old pipes. They took. No leaks, thank God. Days 4 and 5, he was urged to get out of bed. Slowly, he learned how to drag the IV pole down the hall and back. It later doubled in his dreams as an old-fashioned anatomy skeleton that graded with dream speed into the long and lanky figure of his mother. She was still alive somehow. They had longevity, the Barneses, still wrestling with restless leg. And at last, he was her age, ancient, that is, and easy prey for self-pity. 3 tender trips to and from the commode to void urine were celebrated among the medical staff as passionately as any performed by a potty-training toddler. His daily walks were extended, his palate further expanded. On the 10th day, they told him to take a deep breath while they pulled the gastric drain from his abdominal wall. He was coming along like a model patient, was discharged, was monitored remotely until it was time to remove his staples, after which Barbara, taking time off work to see him through, applied aloe and vitamin E to the chapped ridges of his poor wound. Her purse, a leather octopus, lay sprawled on a chair whenever I arrived at the hospital. Her black trench coat, which might come off in a moment of panic, would fall across the floor like a foreshortened shadow, while she attended to some oversight, and the nurse on duty, suddenly superfluous, was left to pick it up and hang it from the door. I would nearly collide with her, rounding the bend into his room as she was on her way out, not to grab a bite, as I had just done, or catch up on her sleep, but to summon someone, to make a small adjustment to my father's care. And on that rare occasion, when I entered and saw no sign of her, a second later, the toilet would roar, and out she would come drying her hands, dressed in the same scrubs she wore to work. Her famously cool disposition, the haughtiness that endeared her to absolutely no one, became, in a hospital setting and in service to him, a breathtaking display of devotion, and a special rebuke to my siblings, for whom the 5th in his line of wives was the worst of the bunch and another reason to hate him. "We've done her a disservice," I was saying to him by day 3 or 4, during one of his lucid spells. "She really loves you, Pop." Tears came to his eyes. "Tell that to the others, will you?"
"I can try." But they didn't care to hear it from me.
When it came time to wheel him out of the hospital and drive him home, it was Barbara who eased over the speed bumps and potholes, avoiding them altogether when possible, so that his delicate reconfigured center, an animal caught in a snare, would not jostle unnecessarily. 44. So he was home. So he would live. So what? The poor man had no appetite for food, for the newspaper, for telephone calls,
and what was life without appetite? He subsisted on black coffee and protein shakes, mortally afraid of moving and tearing internally something he couldn't name but knew he needed. Regrets played on a loop. Depression, that still beast, came to roost. Depression laid its black eggs in him, which hatched, howled for food, and grew stronger on dark thoughts. It was not the cancer, but the reckoning that came close to killing him. To get up in the morning with a big gash in your side, to sweat through breakfast, to tremble, to feel tired and weak, to crawl from spot to spot, to endure, nothing more, and to go on enduring, because it beats the alternative, is to confront the day with a lot of willpower. That was not my father. He sat, did nothing, healed, while time, as changing headlines, turning seasons, continued unabated. His surgeon, a lifesaver and a straightforwardly factual man, stated that the surgical team got clean margins, and chemo was very good at taking care of the rest. But the patient had to eat, or he would not live. The patient just shrugged. What was food to him? Then one morning I set down before him a plate of eggs that I scrambled with whole milk and butter, and that did the trick. He scarfed it down. He wanted nothing but eggs after that, prepared just that way, three at a time, salted and piping hot. It was that perfect meal one goes chasing for years afterward, the rekindling of an appetite given up for dead, a rebirth. And for an entire month, he ate three meals a day of three eggs apiece and nothing more. We watched more TV than you could possibly imagine, more even than when I was in high school and living with him and Evangeline in Downers Grove. Back then, we had a 32-inch Sony Trinitron console set in solid oak, which he worked from his recliner by the luxury of remote control. I was 16 when I bought a replica of that remote at a Radio Shack in the mall and synced it to the television. On nights I was bored, I would climb from my window and stand outside the house on Benton Avenue, moving the volume subtly up and down. Sometimes I changed the channel. Steady Boy liked Channel 7. I liked Channel 9. He would look up from his newspaper. He was never in front of the television without his newspaper, confounded by the sudden change. It seemed to have taken place entirely by some occult power. He reached for his remote on the TV tray and restored order before going back to his newspaper. I would let maybe a minute pass before changing it back to 9. He looked up, very solemn. I still have my regrets about this. I had not yet emerged from my punk-ass bitch phase. What reason did I have to believe Charlie wouldn't abruptly change his mind and send me back to Florida or to foster care? I just wasn't convinced that I deserved the fighting chance he was giving me. I was still smoking, too, and lifting the occasional greeting card. But back to him in that recliner, mouth gone slack in mystification. What the hell is going on with my television? He got to his feet and pulled the curtain back. Insecure Steady Boy was the first to believe that someone might be toying with him, as he peered angrily out into the night. A veteran delinquent, I was well hidden, but silently shaking with laughter because I could still see him. On a different night, he simply stood up and started banging on the television, as if that ever works. Well, why shouldn't it? I correlated one of those bangs with a channel change, then another and another, until he had every reason to believe that his Sony was obeying him, in this crudest of manners, appeasing an angry god, and when at last it could be trusted that Channel 7 would hold, he carefully withdrew, picking across the carpet backward and reaching out with a blind hand for his recliner, keeping his eyes glued to the screen until he was seated again, this time demurely, on the lip of the thing, as if fully occupying it might tempt fate. How carefully he sat there. I gave it a full 2 minutes before returning it to Channel 9. I can't tell you how often he would resort, during this mind-boggling episode, to that impotent hope of the layman, unplugging the TV from the wall socket and plugging it back in again. One night he even dragged poor drowsy Evangeline out of bed just to have someone stand witness to his going mad. Of course, with the two of them in the middle of the room at the stroke of midnight, holding their breath, waiting for something to happen, I didn't do a thing. Remember that old Merry Melodies cartoon about the frog with the golden voice who eventually drives his promoter insane because the beast will sing only for him? That TV went haywire only for Charlie Barnes. I found this amusing, as any teenager might, in the twilight of my not giving a shit before I came to believe in that house and my place in it. Finally, he took the TV in to have it repaired, but they sent it right back for no charge because there was nothing wrong with it. My poor pop. In time, I stopped torturing him like this because I really did think he was going to lose his mind, and because I lost interest. He loved me. In between interruptions, like his consultations and follow-ups, we must have watched close to 1,200 hours of television over the course of his recovery from surgery and his 2 rounds of chemo. We watched or rewatched all of Cheers. We watched at least 2/3 of Seinfeld and half of Friends. Mindless, time-killing sitcoms helped keep him alive. There were also less familiar offerings, niche shows on the Sci-Fi Channel, Canadian whodunits, classic sitcoms he could remember loving back in the day, now so unwatchably bad that he questioned the judgment of his earlier self. If beloved old shows could crater, did that give the lie to today's amusement? Personally, I did not know what to make of the show Lost, which struck me as both aimless and tedious, but uncanny, too, in the way life itself is uncanny, full of a grand, anachronistic, possibly scripted intent. We got through its 6 seasons in 12 days. He was conked out half the time, healing up, or dying a little more, maybe both, who could say, so that each show, each season, each series we completed must have been for him a kaleidoscope of narrative more than any coherent story. When he began to snore, I'd pause the television and peer over at him. I owed him everything. But he hurt me, too, during this time, inadvertently, though it was nothing I didn't already know. We had started watching Downton Abbey, more mindless fare, but every now and again that show went for the jugular, piercing the veil of a pretty little period drama to deliver pure dread. The year is 1912. The heir apparent to Downton Abbey is a lawyer from Manchester called Matthew Crawley. As a newly minted aristocrat, Crawley finds himself chafing against the highbrow customs he's required to sustain. When Mr. Molesley, his proud valet, attempts to help him with his cufflinks, the thoroughly modern Crawley objects to such slavish interference. "Surely," he remarks to the servant, "you have better things to do." Doing his British best to paper over his wounded pride, the servant replies, "This is my job, sir." Crawley scoffs. He looks the man in the eye, in the mirror, and doubles down. "Seems a very silly occupation for a grown man," he says matter-of-factly. Matthew Crawley has done the unspeakable. He has destroyed the fiction that Mr. Molesley requires to go on believing that his life is a useful thing, that it's being spent with dignity and purpose. Without so much as turning to me, Chuck remarked from his recliner, "Sounds like what you do, Jake." There was silence as I peered over at him. "Beg your pardon?" writing novels, he said. All that make-believe. That's a very silly occupation for a grown man, too. It was not an attempt at humor, just a statement of fact. If it was uncharacteristically callow, I don't think he knew it. He went on watching. The scene changed. I must have turned back to the TV. 10 minutes later, he was asleep again. I had believed that a silly occupation for a grown man was dressing in a clown suit and calling yourself Jolly Cholly, or manufacturing and marketing a flying toupee. But apparently, these were sound pursuits compared to the concerted silliness of writing novels. I also believed I had his respect, but he had no more respect for my childish scribblings, comic sketches, and published titles than his ex-wives and children had for Steady Boy and his schemes. He could treat real life as a fiction, wish away this and will that into existence, manipulate the truth and toy with people's feelings, leave off the old dead drafts and start over with a new cast of characters whenever the whim struck, trade an Evangeline in for a Barbara, and swap Downers Grove for Schomburg. He could put all the tactics of the writer's craft to good use in his life, but I was the silly one for making a career of it. 45. I did what I could for Barbara. Tidied, shoveled the driveway when it snowed. No great thanks were ever forthcoming. That was okay. I wasn't there for her. She may have been jealous that I had the luxury to act the hero, cooking for him and driving him to his doctor's appointments, when she was the nurse and natural caretaker between us, not to mention the man's wife. I walked on eggshells whenever she was home from work and even rented an apartment on Roselle Road to make myself scarce on weekends. I was rarely there, but I think it pleased her to know that I had a place to go, that I was a part-time valet like Mr. Molesley and not a permanent fixture. I turned down a residency in Ménherbes, did the grocery shopping. 6 weeks after the Whipple, we took an involuntary hiatus from our television marathon. You might suspect, by that, an infection or sudden fever. It was not so straightforward. It was the middle of the day in Schomburg, capital of TiVo and the kingdom of Netflix, and I was having a hard time keeping the political intrigue straight from the police procedural, the family drama distinct from the science fiction. We spent time in spacecraft and surveillance rooms, in precinct offices, law courts, and strip clubs. Oh, the sound and fury of endless streaming. Yet every 44 minutes or so, I would tune back into the old man who was only ever half awake, and no matter where we'd just been, in Pakistan spoiling a plot, or rooting out a mole at the Pentagon, or solving the metaphysical puzzles of a sudden rapture, I was returned to the ongoing, essentially static, event-free drama unfolding on the recliner in a stuffy suburban living room. The cellular drama that will represent, for most Americans, the only one that threatens, that entangles, that destroys. The small, stupid drama of a person dying of cancer. The biggest and dullest drama on Earth, which might have been called, if it weren't already the title of a TV show, The Facts of Life. The power went out. The TV blinked off, the sound cut to silence. I was roused from a stupor and sat upright. I expected to look over and find Chuck snoring right through it, but he was awake. Indeed, he had collapsed the footrest and was peering deeply into the room as if dazed, mesmerized. He turned to me, and with a curiosity I had seen no sign of since the surgery, asked if I was an alien. A what? An alien? He pointed to the television. It was blank, but I got his meaning. All our news of extraterrestrial beings came from there. Not that I know of, I said. It was a puzzling remark, not quite a joke. A moment later, I did what you do when the power goes out, drifted into the kitchen wondering dumbly whom I might call. When I wandered back into the living room, I found the front door open. Chuck was standing in the yard, peering up at an overcast sky. It was a moody day on Rust Road, full of fog and bruised cloud. As I idly watched from the doorway, he walked to the curb where my rental was parked, opened the door, and climbed in. By the time it dawned on me that he had my car keys and I might want to go after him, stop him, do something, he'd turned the engine over and was rounding the bend out of sight. At last, it made perfect sense. The temptation to blame himself had always been very strong. If a product didn't perform, the marketplace wasn't the problem. The marketplace was efficient. The fault belonged to the inventor and entrepreneur. It belonged to him. His ideas were off. Is there a need for this in the marketplace? These nice people were looking for a good time and you gave them herpes. Do you even have a lawyer? Voices, so many voices, saying, no, not good. Get lost. How could a whole chorus of voices be wrong? What a temptation. He left the neighborhood of Rust Road and gained the expressway, and a mile later pulled off to the shoulder near the interstate exchange. He let the car idle as he opened the door and stood looking out at the traffic converging at junctures east and west, while commercial freight pounded past him and little sedans zipped by. He could feel his hair blow around in the currents. Very unlike him to leave the house without a hat. To the north, the Woodfield Mall. To the east, the city skyline. To the south, stalled traffic glinting under the sun, inching along the highway. And to the west, a steady flow of it bifurcating and shamrocking into the four corners of the earth. And for the first time, he saw it all for what it really was. He got off the highway at the mall exit and paid a visit to the Sears Roebuck. No one called it that anymore. It was just Sears now. This anchor store among the last of its kind. Do you have the Dewlander in stock? He asked an employee who was making a display of pink antifreeze bottles. The what? Endopalm tea? Pardon? Do you have endopalm tea? I don't know what that is, the employee said. I can look it up for you in the system if you'd like. The system. He followed the man over to it where he spelled out endopalm tea, but the system had no match. Is there a different system? He asked. Sir, the man said, pointing down at his feet, you can't be in here without shoes on. He got his start selling shoes. Everyone knew that. But everyone also knew that Sears was by then a shadow of its former self, and they were worried about him? He left. He went next door to an office of H&R Block, the tax prep chain, where he approached the woman sitting behind the front desk. She watched the sickly man approach, hair tousled, in plaid pajama pants and a Fighting Illini sweatshirt. Jimmy Kane, he said. Come again? Little guy. Not, he dropped his voice, much to look at. He offered the woman a universal shrug. What are you going to do?
What are you asking me?
I'm here to see Jimmy Kane.
There's nobody here by the name Jimmy, she said.
He nodded, as if this, too, was entirely predictable.
Little guy, he said. No little guy here,
the woman said.
The little games people play for big profits, he said. Headquarters, mansions, the brand names. Tell him, I don't buy it anymore.
He was light, an organ or two, but in his mind, where it mattered, it was America that had been hollowed out. He left the H&R Block for the Sherwin-Williams next door, where he drifted down the aisles collecting paint samples. The assistant manager approached him.
May I help you?
I invented the spill-proof paint can, he said.
There was a long pause.
Is that right?
In 1971. Worked all night on it. Opened up this can of paint. See, it spills everywhere. I think to myself, gotta be a better way. Gotta be. Next thing you know, I'm doodling. Conceptualizing, you know. Run out to the garage. Bent this in place, bent that. Voila! Spill-proof paint can. Apply for a patent. Patent. Never heard back. 2 years later, open a new can. There's my design. No recognition to this day. True story.
He waited for a reply, but the assistant manager was not human either. Was there one human being left in Schaumburg? Was there one honest, sympathetic, feeling person in all the suburbs? Not at the Sears, not at the tax store, and not here at the place that sold paint either. And I'm sorry, he thought. It was that way throughout Chicagoland, the land of Lincoln, the heartland, and all the rest of America, too. It was stocked full of, crowded up with, overrun by, fakes, frauds, imposters. He couldn't say for sure that every soul had been replaced, or even that he was still alive. A compromised world of fakes, in which he felt ill all the time, fit the description of purgatory pretty well. Either way, was it any great surprise that no product or idea of his had taken hold here? At last, it made perfect sense. His double O's, triple downs, and what have yous, they were never going to gain traction, much less triumph, in a world overrun by extraterrestrial beings. He knew that the minute the power went out. His side hurt. Where they had gone in weeks earlier and, in the guise of healing him, attempted to vacuum out his soul. Only they missed a little, to use their parlance. They failed to get it all. A little soul remained. It was all he needed to see far and wide what had really taken place in this world, and all that was taking place still. Bankruptcy, disability, and homelessness now struck him as entirely advantageous to good fortune. The dispossessed, the disinherited, the ailing, those stuck in terminal holding patterns or arrested by their traumas and living as ghosts were, according to a terrific irony, the last of the living, while the overlords of wealth and good health were counterfeits. Martians? Mothmen? Humanoid flies? Hard to say. They could have been lizards zipped up in skin suits for all his command of the fine print. It was no accident that after the paint store he found himself wandering the county hospital. The old were there, the infected, the immobile, the amputated, the sclerotic, and the deformed. They loitered around the dry fountain, smoking their old-school cigarettes. They choked the hallways with wheelchairs and IV poles. They lay helpless and terrified in their deathbeds, real people with real problems, unlike those invulnerable aliens out there running the show. What a monumental task it would be to roust these sad sacks into a respectable resistance. But that was his final hope, the ailing and enlightened, the last people on earth. He had not had his scrambled eggs and was hungry when he departed the hospital. He took the rental around the drive-thru. 99 billion served, the sign said. He had served no one. He had done nothing. When he got his food, he could not eat it. But at least he understood the disconnect between the sign and himself. What they served was alien grub, and what he required was real person food. The flat gray patties, the nuclear cheese, and the bright red and green goo on top all but crawled before his eyes. This was not a world for living in.
He went around again to demand his money back, a favorite American pastime, but the prospect of attempting to explain all the suffering and outrage involved in 99 billion served to one of the young and healthy drones at the window just frustrated and exhausted him. He gained the highway again and followed the tri-state to I-57 South. Once upon a time, he had done this particular drive every Saturday. Yes, it was back to Danville for Charlie Barnes, back to the good old days, back to high school football games and functioning bowels, and back to the can-do spirit of his youth, drained from him these many years, as if via gastric tube, by the big city and its suburbs. He navigated the drive by feel, leaving the highway for the back roads at Kankakee and taking a left at the first fork, a right at the next. It was a straight shot into Danville from there. Nothing ever seemed quite so nostalgic as the heartland cornfields he passed, the podunk towns. But when he pulled into the driveway of the house on Vermilion, he was inside an unrecognizable rental car, not the old Newport. That was confusing. He tried to recall why he had come. He had lived in that house once. He was real there, young and in love. But time had rendered it unrecognizable. It was crumbling and in need of repair. And no boy ran out to greet him. By the time the owner emerged to investigate why a stranger was parked in his driveway, Charlie was racked with sobs.
"I'm looking for Old Poor Farm," he told the man upon powering down the window, his face wet with tears.
"Old what?"
"The Poor Farm, out on the Catlin-Tilton Road."
That was a real place once, realest place he'd ever known. People helping people, and heaven on earth just around the bend.
"Well," said the man, "if it's the Catlin-Tilton Road you're after."
He followed the man's directions to the Walmart on the former site of Old Poor Farm. No trace of it remained. No more do-gooders in wool suits or pedestal desks holding jars of wheat germ. The social contract was over. Charlie Prophet of Peoria, Illinois, had remarried and was living... where? And was she fake, too? He would have liked to know that at least one thing had been real once upon a... He had to admit to himself something that only a real person could. Time had passed. He had grown old and would die. He needed help. But there was no one around to help him. Even the seasons, with their suggestion of renewal, that crisp touch of fall, that old hint of spring, were gone. He was wandering down an aisle of the Walmart in the purgatorial half-light among the zombie hordes.
"I came up with the soccer ball," he told the cashier.
"You want the sports aisle?"
"Not the soccer ball," he said, amused by his own mistake. "The snow cone. You see, first I shaved some ice into a little cup. I did it for Jerry. Then I dabbed a little, what do you call it? I didn't call it a snow cone, I called it poor man's ice cream. Marketing is everything. Timing, too."
The cashier looked to the bagger for help.
"I never had good timing."
The bagger said, "Mister, you buying something?" He found within reach a display of candy bars. At last, real food. He took one Charleston Chew, one box of Good and Plenty, and two or three other old familiar items and placed them on the belt. Back in the rental car, he sucked on some Milk Duds in the handicapped spot. A pair of Danville police officers found him the next morning, 2 a.m., asleep in the front seat. Barbara and I had been looking for him almost 24 hours by then.
"If you can't take care of him, why are you here?" she asked me. "Do I need to hire someone?"
I didn't know he had my keys, and I didn't think he had the energy.
"First you let my dog out to die, Now it's my husband.
For the millionth time, I said, I didn't know it was an inside dog.
I should have just agreed to let Marcy come, she said. Marcy is a disaster, but at least she's competent.
Why is Marcy a disaster?
She's a spoiled brat. She sabotages everyone's happiness. She doesn't believe her father even deserves happiness. She's an asshole. Marcy is an asshole.
Does Chuck know that's how you feel? If Chuck were honest with himself, he would feel the same way.
But that's his daughter. He can't afford to be honest.
You've never liked her, I said.
No, I never have.
And me? I asked.
She made no reply.
I was no fool. I didn't press her. It was her house, her husband. I was at her mercy. Marcy in Deer Park, Jerry on Western Avenue, Evangeline in Newport Richey. Not much of a family to speak of without Steady Boy.
No one thinks of you, she said, almost as an afterthought.
We were driving through the night. Dawn broke as we arrived at the hospital in Champaign-Urbana, where he had been taken for medical evaluation and where I, too, had spent some time as a newborn. Barbara killed the ignition and was reaching for the door when I caught her arm.
I screwed up, I said. Give me another chance.
She paused before answering.
There are times when I honestly don't know who you are or why you're here, she said.
She got out of the car. She would later apologize. He was transferred to First Baptist, where he was treated for psychosis with lithium and a second antipsychotic. It was less than ideal. He badly needed to seize that particular moment in time to start chemo, but he was too weak and weighed too little and was out of his mind anyway. It would have to wait. One of the doctors on his tumor board alerted Barbara to a case study from 1998, in which a patient who underwent a Whipple procedure became convinced some 6 weeks later that he was Bill Clinton. The trauma of that particular operation could produce a break with reality similar to the one experienced by soldiers on a battlefield. With help from the medication, he had admirable recall of these events and detailed them for me with a bafflement that rivaled my own. There had been other occasions in which the power had gone out, and he hadn't left the house to confirm a world overrun by extraterrestrials. What was different this time? It was, he thought, the result of an estrangement from all that he knew and loved on account of his compromised body. A world in which he had no appetite for a glass of cold milk, a tub of buttered popcorn, or a fresh sports page no longer made sense as the world. 46. There had been a brief window between that first serving of scrambled eggs and his kind of losing his mind there when he and I, between episodes of TV, resumed debating back and forth as we had been doing my entire life. The object of our debates had never mattered much. As inveterate gamblers never care about the nature of the contest upon which they lay down their money, as old addicts never mind what gets them high, chronic and incorrigible debaters like me and Chuck happily went at it over anything and everything. The pros and cons of a packet of salt, the performance of an orphaned earplug. It was our way of paying a compliment to the richness of the world and of each other's minds. We debated in private, on road trips and in restaurants, and we debated in mixed company until everyone else got drowned out and grew bored stiff. We didn't know when to quit. Just as the birthday cake was coming out, as our heads were bowing for prayer, as the final strains of the national anthem were sending shivers down the collective spine, on we went, eager to make one last point in a low murmuring aside, neither one willing to concede defeat. Was grunge the equal of opera? Could concentration camps take root here in America?
was a poet, a salesman, when he published his chapbook, or by nature something more pure? Some of our debating was downright dull and gave even me a headache. But it was our sport, our bond, an expression of love and measure of our mutual respect. Only now we debated how he might repair his relationship with his daughter. Does she really hate me? I don't think she hates you, no. She's just angry. She won't call, Jake. She won't pay me a visit. She knows the cancer's real. I've apologized for the lie. What more can I do? Marcy had every right to be angry with Charlie. She'd been manipulated the day of his diagnosis, quit her job to fly to Chicago, had to learn from Jerry that her father had lied, and then had to maintain her resolve to make him pay a price for all this bad behavior. Even as he was put under and cut open and so vastly diminished that he was almost unrecognizable. I'd flown down to, where was it again? Oh yes, Deer Park, Texas. I'd flown to Texas to encourage her to join us in the waiting room on the day of his surgery. Had even purchased an airline ticket for her to this end, but she could not be persuaded. She had made up her mind. Her father was a con man, and nothing, not pancreatic cancer or the Whipple procedure or a daily dose of antipsychotics, was ever going to make him get real. It wasn't lost on me that when Charlie momentarily broke with reality, he conceived of himself as the genuine article in a world of fakes and imposters. It was never his aim to live life as a farce. His every harebrained scheme was intended to make him more real in the eyes of the world and in his daughter's. He had to shoulder responsibility for his trouble with Marcy. But there was also at play here a legacy of the past. As a younger, more impressionable person, Marcy had been heavily influenced by her mother's poor opinion of her father. A divorce didn't seem sufficient for Charlie Prophet in her repudiation of her ex-husband. Falling in love with Charlie, marrying him, having his children, all that mortified her. She had been tricked by his full beard. When she found the man she was looking for in Dickie Dicker Dick, she needed not merely to put Charlie in the past, she wanted to erase him from the historical record. To that end, she turned Dickie into Dad. "Ask your father," she'd say, in reference not to the man we'd grown up with from time immemorial, but to the virtual stranger who had driven us to Florida for a sun-kissed fresh start. "Let's give your father a call. What would your dad say? Wait until your father gets home." Dickie wasn't our dad, and he was a far cry from fatherly. But he was very convenient as a shiny decoy in the systematic whitewashing of Charlie Barnes. Saying Charlie's name in earshot of Charlie Prophet became almost as awkward and ultimately forbidden as the conjuring of Evangeline Barnes would be years later in the company of Barbara Ledoux. It was really impressive, the genius these people had for ghost stories. I knew my task in Deer Park was a tall one, but no one else could afford to fly down there and plead his case in person, which was what he deserved. I rented a car and booked a room, then called her to let her know I'd arrived. "Arrived where?" she asked. "The hotel," I said, "the place I stayed last time." "Hold on," she said. "You're back in Deer Park?" "Yes, Deer Park."
"What the hell? Jake, you can't just keep popping up in Texas," she said. "Don't you know I live here for a reason?"
"What reason is that?"
"To be as far away from you people as possible."
"I was hoping we could get another drink," I said.
"You don't drink."
"Dinner, then."
"I've eaten. It's noon."
She agreed to meet at the sports bar where we'd met previously. I caught her up on his so-called recovery, his brief break with reality, and how it forced the delay of urgently needed chemotherapy. I don't know that any of it did much good. Since his operation, she'd played things close to the vest. No flowers, no get-well cards, no texts or emails, no fruit baskets. No curiosity, it would seem, for how the old man was faring in the fight for his life. But that was Marcy, wasn't it? A mystery, a kind of split personality. You just never knew from day to day which one you were going to get. I made a final case for why he deserved a little mercy. Then I went silent. She looked off. When she turned back, she had tears in her eyes.
Is he dying?
He might be. I don't know.
He's hurting?
He's very definitely hurting.
Because of me?
Because he is who he is, I said, and because he wishes to be someone better.
Who doesn't? She asked. Except for maybe you, Jake.
Oh, don't be so sure, I said. I'm full of surprises.
Why are you here? She asked. Have you really come all the way to Texas just to repair his relationship with me?
I owe him, I said.
You could have called.
I nodded.
If I were you, I wouldn't have come, she said. I would have fled this family a long time ago and never looked back.
I like you guys.
You like him.
I love him, I said. She looked off again.
Okay, she said. Let me give it some thought.
It was about as much as I could hope for, and I flew back to Chicago the next day. 47. Christmas on Rust Road was a subdued affair. Sugar cookies in tins and an artificial tree. Barbara's spinster sister, the mysteriously named Darge, came with her irrepressible nervous tic, the animatronic need to rotate her head 60 degrees to the right every 10 seconds or so. She weighed 90 pounds and wore a Christmas sweater. Barbara's children, Troy Ledeux, on leave from the army, and Tori, a tire saleswoman for Pirelli, had developed in their adult years a curious sibling connection, despite their difference in age. When in the comforts of home, their hair down and feet bare, my step-siblings became preoccupied by their persistent little teases, hem-pullings, back-massages, high private squeals of laughter, impromptu wrestling matches that drove them out of the kitchen and into the living room, and finally those settled, languid moments when, as decaf brewed after the holiday dinner, the sister sat on the brother's lap and idly began petting the hair on his arm. "Tori and Troy are awfully close," I whispered to Charlie in a private moment on Christmas Day. "What's that about?" "I make no inquiries into that relationship, Jake. But you agree it's odd." "I don't even know what you're talking about," he said with a shit-eating grin. His first post-Whipple Christmas, when his most ardent wish had been to celebrate in the company of loved ones the additional time he'd been granted, was instead a thunderous rebuke to the life that had preceded the Whipple, because his children refused to participate. When Jerry, who lived all of 20 miles away, declined to stop by, he had to contend with the clearest evidence yet of a perfectly failed life. In fact, I fixed the date of the first steps he took to change that life to the day after Christmas, when, early in the morning, I returned to the house on Rust Road with bags of salt for de-icing the driveway, to find the television off and the old man in his recliner reading a book. "He's up already," I said, "and reading the Bhagavad Gita?" He half-shrugged as I resumed my place on the end of the sofa nearest him. I'd taken off my shoes before entering Barbara's house, of course, a rule I'd been following for 15 years. "It renders death meaningless, apparently," he said.
"Hey, we should all be reading it."
"Jerry thinks so. This is his favorite thing."
"Oh," I said. "You don't say."
The mention of Jerry brought back his absence the day before, and Charlie looked downcast.
"I'm determined to make it through this time, Jake."
"To edify your soul or to please Jerry?"
"I would like to please Jerry," he said.
"But I'd better say the soul part, or he'll tell me I'm reading it all wrong."
"You can't read a book wrong anymore, Chuck, not in the age of Amazon reviews."
"Tell me something, Jake," he said. "What's Dharma?"
"I have always consigned the desiderata of religious concepts, with their dry abstractions and dubious utilities, to a junk drawer of the mind, where inevitably they went to get all jumbled up and die of unholy neglect. I rummaged around now for Dharma, but came up empty-handed."
"Do you want the Buddhists' use of the term, or the Hindus?"
He looked uncertain.
"Joking," I said. "I don't actually know the difference. I run Literature 101, remember? Jerry's in charge of advanced religion."
"I'll tell you what I think it is," he said. "I think it means a calling in life. The one thing you were meant to do. You and you alone. Your duty, I guess. Almost a holy duty."
"For me," I said, "that would be taking care of you, Chuck."
"For you," he replied, correcting me, "it would be writing books. I've always admired that about you, Jake. Your determination. You've known you were a writer since you read Hemingway. How old were you when you first read Hemingway?"
"Well, it was Dostoevsky," I said, "and I was 12.
12 years old and reading Hemingway.
It was Dostoevsky.
I never did anything like that. I don't do anything like it now. 69 years old, son, and not likely to live all that much longer."
"Don't say that, Pops. Don't even think it.
And I still don't know what I want to be when I grow up. What is it, Jake? What's my duty? What's my dharma?"
Was he asking rhetorically?
"Financial planning," I said. He dismissed that with a wave of the hand.
"What about chipping in?"
The look he returned was so curious. Curiosity itself.
"What is that?" he asked.
"Chipping in?"
His eyes had brightened.
"I know that, don't I? What is that?"
"You don't remember?"
"Tell me what that is. I know it."
He had no recollection. His dear idea, his million-dollar delight, had been rubbed out, effaced from the poor man's memory by his pancreatic ordeal. The only commercial concept ever endorsed by his stingy brother Rudy, the hotshot. The bastard who, when his brother fell ill, couldn't be bothered to visit him over the holiday, despite my efforts to get him on the phone and plead with him. Charlie had clung to chipping in, prior to surgery, as his last best hope, only to wake whippled and wiped clean. But that, too, by God, yes, even that, here his buoyant voice can't help but break through in memory, had its upside. For suddenly he found himself in one of those time-traveling, role-swapping, richly ironic scenarios that he and I knew so well from our hours of television viewing, in which he could have his own idea pitched to him by a cosmic surrogate. Would it warp the space-time continuum? Would it, more unlikely still, measure up? The minute I began to explain the concept, it came back to him, of course. But he insisted I revive every detail. When I finished doing so, I watched him closely for his reaction. Suddenly, he sprang forward on his recliner,
collapsing the footrest in a fit that made the whole thing ring, and seized upon my knee with a strong hand, just as he would have done in his days before the Whipple. "Not too shabby an idea, my boy."
I loved him. The Gita, I remember, had fallen between the chair and the footrest before the ladder came thundering down, and so was swallowed up. On the first Monday of the new year, he clopped into the kitchen in suit and tie, his old perfumed and polished self. Our plan was to hit the banks. In his day, a proper bank had pillars and vaults and echoes ringing in the airy halls, and gentlemen bankers in three-piece suits whose Rolodexes would unlock at the sound of a good idea. But times had changed. The suburban branches of those Wall Street banks that we paid visits to that day, from Roselle Road to Route 53 to Pitch Chippin' Inn, were as close to the halls of power as Kay was to the castle. We began with one bank in particular, whose corporate parent, he believed, would be the quickest to see the synergies between his brainchild and their mission statement. But where he hoped to find venture capital, there were only padded armchairs and free peppermints, and a branch manager busy converting an old lady's loose change into dollar bills. And we left that glass box with little more than brochures. The mood of the financial markets in that winter of our Great Recession was grim. No one had any business asking anyone else for money unless that money was already theirs, and even then it wasn't a sure thing. I did take heart, however, as we went from bank to bank, at seeing a tie knotted at his neck again. Though pinning an old waddle in place, it restored his youthful vigor. He was jazzed again. He had purpose that morning. If he was also taking catnaps between our destinations, at least he was back out there, making an effort. Of course, he looked like hell warmed over. And by then, he hated bankers. From their branches hung too many sour grapes. More revelations about Bear Stearns had come to light. Lehman had failed the previous September, and the mortgage mess was in full swing. His faith in a fair game was gone, and he took to calling the banks the Five Families. In practical terms, the day was a bust. The recent college grads manning the teller windows didn't know what to do with him, while their betters and the open plans had little to offer beyond a business card. Upon saying the words "chippin' in," he might as well have been standing there in loincloth and sandals with a cow on a leash. This was the glad-handing Charlie Barnes that Jerry most despised. He would have had no appetite for it. Dropping in unannounced on play-acting bankers in glorified ATMs to discuss the funding of a goofy idea would have put the lie to more than the American dream. It would have stripped away the illusions necessary for maintaining life itself, and Jerry would have retreated behind a potted plant. Steady Boy's brash self-confidence, when a good idea graced his pocket, despite the 100 others now tarnished and parked in some coffee can, clung to Jerry, as the father's iniquities are said to cling under the third and fourth generations. Even I was a little embarrassed on Chuck's behalf. I loved him and wanted to help. But did he really believe he'd start inking contracts at the Schaumburg City Bank? What self-deceptions we require to get out of bed in the morning. The clown in your town, the original Newlander, TTAA, now chipping in. I was so moved by this pitiable string of failed campaigns that I parked and ran around my rental to the passenger side door before he could even reach for the handle. I opened the door to the bank for him, too. I watched in dread as he pitched his idea to a teenager in suit and tie. And I walked defeated through the parking lot with him on our return to the car. "What do I need these clowns for?"
he asked from the passenger seat after I climbed in and shut the door.
They're a bunch of crooks anyway. I know this idea inside out. I don't need a damn bank. I just need to put it online. Let people look at it for themselves. If they take to it, great. Beats going hat in hand to a bunch of fucking school kids.
By March of the new year, his doctors determined that he was strong enough to start chemotherapy, 4 unfortunate months behind schedule. By then, the website for Chippin' In had gone live. Not particularly warm or attractive, in fact profoundly ugly, and almost purely functional, it required daily upkeep and administration, which he outsourced to a company in India for a mere $19 a month. He shrugged. Not exactly a life's calling, he concluded. 48. It preoccupied him. Everyone had a calling. It depressed him. He had not found his. It gave him hope. He might still do so before he died. In the days leading up to his first round of chemo, he spoke to Barbara about it, while I eavesdropped from the other room. She might have reasonably suggested that it was too late for him to find some calling in life, that he stop with the pipe dreams and focus on gaining his strength back. But she was quite solicitous of the old man and asked what a calling might look like for him. Was it spiritual in nature? Did it involve travel or education or activism? It was only then that he revealed he had 3 ideas in mind. Divorce mediator, for which he already had the tagline, a fair hand, always. A journalist of some kind, preferably on the opinion page, or a toy developer. Conceptor? He didn't know the exact term or career trajectory. But, he said to Jerry the next day,
you get the idea.
Why not a 4th?
Tell it to me, Charlie said. I'm eager to hear it.
General manager of the Chicago Cubs.
As condescending laughter rolled into Jerry's apartment from distant locker rooms, golf clubs, and corporate perches of the imagination, Charlie recoiled.
If you're just going to laugh at me, Jerry, to hell with you.
We had arrived at his walk-up an hour earlier, a rundown hovel on Chicago's west side, only to stand on the stoop for 20 minutes, pressing the buzzer in vain. Jerry, asleep or stoned, or coolly debating his desire to let us up, finally shot the bolt. I took one look at him, a big man in denim cutoffs and a soiled t-shirt, and thought, my God, even in winter.
Cold out here, man. What took you so long?
The timbre of annoyance in the old man's voice told me we might be headed for a bruiser.
Buzzer's on the fritz, Jerry said. Come on up.
The stairs were a minefield.
Watch that hole, boys,
he said, and a hole it was, passing straight through a middle stair on the first flight and into a dark abyss.
Had a bowling ball done that?
But no, it looked gnawed.
Sawed?
Who knows? I stepped over it and saw the sign in my mind's eye. Failed stairs, half off. As we climbed, every turn and transition to a new odor told of the distance Jerry had traveled from the one-time respectable suburban homeowner to the dumpster-diving dropout with self-sabotaged credit. For Jerry, unemployment was the only principled stand in modern-day America, as the alternative was to work for rapists and thieves, which he would no longer do. His time was better spent diagnosing the power structures of neoliberalism via YouTube while reading deeply in his Eastern religion. The result was the radicalizing of a distinctly American monk, dropped out, plugged in, metaphysically enlightened, but politically enraged. He was all tenderness one minute, all terror the next, a condition mitigated when it wasn't made worse by his marijuana intake.
Without offering me a reason, he had apologized for standing me up the night before the old man's surgery. I'd tried to get him to join us for Christmas to no avail. I kept encouraging him to talk to me, to unburden himself to someone who loved him unconditionally, but he was almost 50 years old and fixed in his ways, and I don't think he gave a damn if I was in town or not. We reached the top landing, and he invited us in. Jerry had owned, at various times, such diverse keepsakes as a piece of the Berlin Wall, brass bells from a Kyoto monastery, and Jim Croce's acoustic guitar. He had owned bird cages and stone carvings of the Buddha, electric grills and full-length mirrors, matching furniture and a set of encyclopedias. Those days were over. With the exception of the kitchen table and a mattress in the corner, his apartment was bare. I had driven Charlie over there that day so that he could discuss Dharma with his professor in advanced religion. To what extent was that just a pretense to see Jerry and to dispel the awful memory of the last time they were together, when they went at each other like wolves? That would have been a sour note to end on, and was perhaps why Jerry, with a regret or two of his own, had let us in. Presently, he said, "Why divorce mediator, Pop?" Naturally, the old man just shrugged. "I have a lot of experience with divorce," he said.
"Look, I'm impressed you finally read the thing."
"To be honest, Jerry, I'm not quite finished with the Gita yet."
"But you're going about this all wrong. None of those things is your Dharma."
"How do you know?"
"Because Dharma isn't what you want to do, or what you'd like to do, or what you dream of doing. It's what you must do, Dad, without hope of personal gain. It's duty, not bliss or excitement or even contentment."
"Well, what is that for me?"
"How should I know?"
"Well, how the hell should I?
It's your Dharma."
"Oh, for Christ's sake."
They fell silent. Jerry rummaged around an ashtray for an old joint, lit it, and inhaled. Such a profusion of pot smoke erupted from him a second later. It was like watching a steam engine leave the station. It put me in mind, for some reason, of Anna Karenina, and following that thought to its logical end, I concluded that Jerry combined the uncompromising Levin with the passionate Anna in a single soul. He was an idealist who would shake off propriety even if it meant suicide, but to the casual observer, he looked like nothing more than a drunken serf. Charlie gazed off, lost in his own little world. I sat mute and anxious. I saw the fight coming and wondered why on earth it was so hard for them to get along.
"Tell me something, Jerry," the old man finally said. "What is your Dharma?"
"Mine?"
he gasped, before releasing more pot smoke.
"What's it look like?" he said. "To resist."
I suppose that was true in a way, but not, I thought, for the reasons Jerry believed. By organizing his life around dumpster diving and YouTube and the withholding of rent from modern-day plantation owners, he was not resisting corporate America, the neoliberal crooks and the politicians who enabled their crimes. He was resisting Charlie Barnes. He was rejecting Charlie, sending back his insufficient love, his bungled attempts at parenting, and the disappointing example he set as a man in the world. It did not matter that, without a loving father inviting him to come live in the house on Vermilion Street one troubled morning in 1975, Jerry would have had no place to call home and no family to belong to. He was not especially grateful. His main concern was not becoming the old man. But a son's revolt against his father usually ends in parody, and in Jerry's case, it had the perverse effect of delivering him more quickly to the fate he hoped to avoid. Jerry had bowed out of work,
society, the hidebound world, and all the exacting rules by which it operated, all in order to avoid the old man's fate. But bowing out was a Barnes special. He was Charlie Barnes, though he was blind to it.
"Bud, I have news for you," he said to us both. "It's time I made a few changes."
We carry around ideas of people in our heads, fixed ideas of their character, and firm predictions of how they'll behave, what they'll say before the hour is up, and the facial expressions they'll make that will unaccountably get under our skin. We tell stories about them that never vary, never improve, then confirm that our ideas are accurate every time we get reacquainted. I expected Jerry to do everything I predicted he would do that day. Sit back, smoke pot, spoil for a fight. Above all, take exception to everything Chuck said. Brook no opposition, provide no comfort, give no ground. He'd be in no great hurry to leave for brunch either, which was yet another reason we were there, to take him out to eat, be a goddamn family again, grateful that the old man was still around to break bread with. Well, sure enough, that came to pass. We would not sit for our meal until noon, by which time I was peckish and annoyed. But there was also this little revelation that he needed to make some changes. He confounded me that day. Jerry completely confounded me.
"Fact of the matter is, boys, old Jerry needs a job."
"A real job?" Charlie asked.
"Or a job in Belgium?"
"A proper job," he said.
He frowned, sat back, plucked at his t-shirt so that it fell more favorably over the belly.
"What the hell have I been doing these past few years? What is the point of living like this?"
He gestured around at the hovel.
"What about the rapists and thieves?" Charlie asked.
"A man still has to make a living."
"Do you mean it this time? Or are you still pulling my leg?"
"Look around you, Pop. This is no way to live. So the world doesn't deserve me. The world doesn't deserve many of us. Is that a good excuse for becoming somebody else's problem?"
These extraordinary words stunned his audience of two. They were just so unexpected from such a hard and resolute man as Jerry. Was change really possible in one such as he? Perhaps we shouldn't have believed him. This was, after all, the same man capable of lying about living and working in Belgium. Regardless, tears welled up in the old man's eyes. Big, fat, happy mothers that sprang to the surface out of nowhere. He was prone to emotional upheavals after his surgery, but it was a special relief to know that his son would have health insurance again. And all of Jerry's spiritual drive had curdled into complaint over the years and turned him into a big grouch. Well, here was some of that original spirit again.
"Where's this coming from, Jerry? The sudden reversal and sudden insight?"
"Some of it comes from Jake."
"From me?" I said.
"Sure, you. Some of the things you said to me the other night at the bar."
We had, in fact, managed to get together at last, after he stood me up three times running, and though I make it a point not to drink, we drank like brothers that night, as good brothers must from time to time, and had us a heart-to-heart.
"I heard you that night," he said now. "I heard you loud and clear."
I couldn't believe that whatever I said to him in a drunken stupor had really prompted him to make an attempt to turn his wayward life around. Did it ever work like that? More likely, it was his living conditions, no working buzzer, and no furnishings, and a hole in his stairs. It was diving into dumpsters, the toll that was taking on his body. He was gaining weight, his asthma was getting worse. He dropped into the ER as others do the post office.
It was not having the insurance necessary to cover the cost of a trip to the ER. It was driving that van of his. No one in his right mind would get behind the wheel of that van. If it were me, I'd have found work just to be done with those ratty-ass denim cutoffs.
"And I have 30 days to make these changes," he said, "because in 30 days I'll be homeless."
"Homeless?"
"Got the eviction notice yesterday."
There it was, the real cause for a return to the workplace. An eviction notice. "Jerry, don't you know in a million years I could never let you go homeless?"
"I couldn't live in Barbara's house, Pop."
"But it's my house too, son. It's your father's house, where you always have a place at the table."
"And a pillow to lay my head?"
"Damn right."
"Sorry, Pop. Can't do it."
"You'd rather be out on the street?"
"In this weather, you bet."
"It's March."
"Well, then just imagine how nice summer will feel."
"Oh, Jerry, don't be an ass."
There was a long pause. "Here it comes," I thought. "The bruiser. They will come to blows and end in a single bloody heap."
But in a development more remarkable than his decision to get a job, Jerry did not escalate or insist on having the last word. He changed the subject. I couldn't believe it. When it first dawned on me that it was taking place, I was nearly moved to tears. He might have simply been evading further discussion of living at 105 Rust Road, but he was also showing the old man respect.
"There he is," I thought, "the deferential, expansive, sweet-natured Jerry I've always most admired. That particular individual has never made an appearance in these pages." "It was wrong of me to lie about going to Belgium," he said. "I had no right to remake reality for you like that. I was writing you off, Pop, with that lie, washing my hands of you, and I never want to wash my hands of you. I need you. I owe you so much. I was worried I was going to lose you." "Listen," he said, "I'm sorry we got into it like we did."
"No, I'm sorry, Jerry. Some of the things I said to you that day..."
"That was my doing, Pop. You didn't need me showing up with another damn copy of the Gita. You needed some compassion, and I had to taunt you about Jimmy Kane."
"I deserved that," Charlie said.
"Anyway, I'm sorry I didn't visit more often when you were in the hospital. As Jake pointed out the other night, I can be full of dumb pride and more than a little self-absorbed. I let all these stupid resentments from childhood hang over us. What's the point of that?" "Forgive me," he said. "Let's start over. What do you say?" Charlie, who loved nothing more than a second chance, shot up and threw his arms around Jerry, who hardly had time to react. He returned his father's embrace while struggling to right himself. Finally on his feet, the chair tipped over. They hugged in the middle of that bare and happy room, that awful room. When they finally broke off, both wiping away tears, my father said, "You won't have any problem finding something." "I don't know, Pop. It's not like anyone's hiring at the moment."
"You're brilliant, Jerry. You have advanced degrees."
"I've been out of the workforce a while now."
"This is America. People are always hiring somewhere."
We went to brunch.
Before our coffee arrived, Charlie walked across the street to an ATM and withdrew what he could and came back and handed it to Jerry. He tried to take out more after our brunch was over, but his card was declined. "Hold it," he said, as we were dropping Jerry back at his apartment. He removed the Rolex that I mentioned a long time ago, on page 13 or 14, the sole authentic item in a collection of fakes, which both Jerry and I associated with him from the start of time, and offered it to Jerry in the back seat. He was done thinking about his calling for the time being, that's for damn sure. Jerry thanked him, but refused to accept it and got out of the car. On our return to Rust Road, the poor old man had to pull over. He put the car in park on the highway shoulder and wept for his son, and I could do nothing to comfort him. One morning, 6 weeks later, ruined, wrecked Charlie Barnes emerged from the house on Rust Road to retrieve the newspaper. The Tribune arrived at the end of the driveway, tightly sheathed in a skin of blue plastic, a bitter contrast to the cells inside him that the chemotherapy drugs had reduced to so many bloated water balloons, thin sacks of poison on fire that, when popped, poured into his veins and pooled like toxic lakes throughout his body. With every heavy step, he felt like dead man sloshing. Now he sloshed unhappily down the drive toward the aforementioned paper, which looked about 10 miles distant and which he would not have the energy to read that day. And on his slog back, there was Jerry standing against the garage door in his cutoffs and t-shirt, a single duffel bag at his feet. It was reminiscent of that morning so long ago when the boy had run away from his mother's house into his father's arms, or onto his porch, anyway. He had been reluctant to knock on the door that morning, too, lest he wake Charlie Prophet of Peoria, Illinois. Now it was Barbara Ledeux he might wake, which made him doubly reluctant. But Barbara hadn't kept Jerry away. He had lost his apartment. He had sold his van. He had swallowed his pride. He simply had nowhere else to go.